The Church of God, the Eternal, presents the second message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, January 11th, 2025.
Well, as promised, we're going to dive in now to the book of 1 Samuel. I gave you the setup, the prelude, the run-up to an analysis of the entire books of 1 and 2 Samuel a couple of weeks ago, or actually probably more than that now, since it was before my last trip, I believe. And in that, now, I gave you an overview. I tried to keep it as simple as possible, and I know that's still hard to do. But a background on the history of the writing and the compiling of the books, not only of 1 and 2 Samuel, but 1 and 2 Kings, because all four of those books together, as I showed you, originally, probably from the Jewish history, were considered in one set, called the Books of the Kings. Because 1, 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, and 2 Kings show a progressive story all the way through. Okay, so those books really do seem to go together as a set. And then I made some comments on the books of 1 and 2 Chronicles as well, which duplicate the story in the books of 1 and 2 Kings. But as I gave you a quick overview, the unique thing about Chronicles is that it gives you a lot of the genealogies that we don't like to spend our time reading, but are valuable and God intentionally preserved for reason. So the history of these families and their lineage in every tribe going back, which became very important for the resettlement of the Jews who came out of Babylonian captivity after 70 years and then got reestablished back in the Holy Land again, those genealogies were very, very important to establish who was who and who had a right to what land, which was the main element, let alone the proof of the priesthood. Because remember, those who attended at the temple, in the tabernacle before the temple, had to be Levites in particular, and more specifically of the house of Aaron, one particular family line of the tribe of Levi. So Chronicles gives all of that confirmation, likely compiled by Ezra the prophet after or toward the end of the Babylonian captivity. But it provides a lot of valuable information. Even though you and I don't like reading the genealogies, I'm going to give you one instance today where the genealogy actually comes into play and is helpful. So we're going to get in now to 1 Samuel chapter 1 and see how far we can get with the story now of first the prophet Samuel. And then again, as I told you at the beginning of this series, my real intent is to cover the life of David. Okay, but I'm not just going to pick and choose out snippets. I want to give it all in context. And so the beginning of this starts first with the life of Samuel the prophet. And of course, here in verse 1 of Samuel 1, we have now the reference to the parents of Samuel. So here we begin. Now there was a certain man of Ramathaim Zophim of Mount Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zoph, an Ephrathite. Okay, can we just skip past that because we want to get to the story, right? No, we can't skip past it because there's some important information in here that I think is very valuable for us to get in the context. Because what this is telling us, now this is the father of Samuel. So it's important to know, or valuable to understand, what was the lineage of Samuel. One, which tribe did he come from? Well, this seems to say that the father of Samuel maybe was an Ephraimite. It says, you know, after all this thing, that an Ephrathite. Is that what this says? And the answer is no. Actually, Samuel was a Levite. What? I don't see that anywhere in here. But Elkanah, his father, we do have This is only an abbreviated genealogy right here. It only goes back several generations back to his ancestor named Zuph, Z-U-P-H, and says that Zuph was an Ephrathite. Well, what does that mean? It actually means he was when living in a town or an area called Ephrathah. So this is really referencing to where he lived, not what his genealogy was according to the tribes. Okay? Now it also says a certain man of Ramathaim Zophim of Mount Ephraim. And so I looked all of this up through the commentaries, and the commentaries don't all agree on this, and I'm not going to hang my hat on any of it, but I think there's some snippets that we can pull out of this which will be valuable for us. Elkanah was not an Ephraimite. He was not of the tribe of Ephraim, which was one of the tribes of Joseph. No, he was a Levite. I'm going to prove that to you momentarily. Recall that the Levites had no land given to them by God. When God parceled out all of the promised land to the tribes of Israel, the Levites didn't get property like all the other tribes did. The Levites were given cities in every tribe because the purpose of the tribe of Levi was to do the religious service to the entire nation. So part of what God did was he did not give the Levites estates like all of the families of every other tribe got. In fact, they were distributed throughout all 12 tribes. So they had home, they had places that they lived, especially there were certain cities that were called, Levitical cities, where they lived and did the religious work for the local areas in which they served. But that's an important thing to understand. Elkanah's ancestors in particular, what this is confirming, were from Ephrathah. Well, where was that and who cares? Actually, the name given it later was none other than Bethlehem. So if you just read 1 Samuel 1:1 and you want to skip through the genealogy and the details and kind of move on to the story, but it's kind of valuable, at least interesting, to understand that the father of Samuel actually was probably born and raised in what is modern-day Bethlehem. Now, if you get out your Bible maps, probably from the back of your Bible, and look, if you have a map in there that gives you a picture of what the original division of land by tribes as God gave it. You'll find, and I'll do everything in relationship to Jerusalem because that's pretty easy to find on the biblical maps. And some of you don't care about it. I'm going to try and give at least a synopsis of places in relationship to other places as we kind of go through the stories. Bethlehem is south of Jerusalem. Jerusalem was technically in the tribal lands assigned to Benjamin barely. It was right there on the edge between Judah and Benjamin. Okay, then to the north and to the west was Ephraim. Okay, so the question is, where was Elkanah and his family actually living? Elkanah apparently was born and raised in Bethlehem. But this says that he was actually living in this town called Ramathaim Zophim. Why such a long name? Because there were about five different towns in Israel called Ramath. You know, there was Ramath Gilead, and there's Ramath this and Ramath that. This is one particular one. And it says in particular here of Mount Ephraim. Okay, where was that? That literally was in the tribal land assigned to Ephraim, the Ephraimites. All right. So apparently, now the commentators don't agree, and some of them want to say, well, no, this is just another name for the fact that he was still living around Bethlehem, and that's where all this was taking place. I think it's more likely that, no, Elkanah was raised in Bethlehem, but now was living with his family in the tribe of Ephraim at near Mount Ephraim, okay, which was to the north and to the west of Jerusalem. All right, for whatever that's worth. What about the genealogy? And how do we know that he was actually a Levite? Ah, let's go to Chronicles. 1 Chronicles chapter 6. This is where those boring genealogies are going to help us out. 1 Chronicles 6, verse 31, I'm going to read 31 through 38. This is now, and again, because Chronicles was compiled likely by the prophet Ezra for the purpose of confirming all these families for the service of the temple, for the assignment of the land in the promised land, and for those who were legitimately allowed in order to serve at the temple. And so here, 1 Chronicles 6:31, these are they whom David set over the service of song. Ah, there were musicians who were assigned, and the music was a key part of the worship of God in the tabernacle and ultimately in the temple after Solomon was inspired by God to build it. Set over the service of the song in the house of the Eternal after the ark had rest. And they ministered before the dwelling place of the tabernacle of the congregation with singing until Solomon had built the house of the Eternal in Jerusalem. And then they waited on their office according to their order. So these are all of these legitimate servants now during the days that the house of God was still in tent form, called the tabernacle, and ultimately transition now into their permanent post once the final temple was built. All right, now that's the setup. Verse 33, and these are they that waited with their children, meaning these families who had authorization to do this service at the temple. Of the sons of the Kohathites, who are they? Well, we're going to find out. Of the sons of the Kohathites, Heman, a singer, the son of Joel, the son of Shemuel. Who's that? That's Samuel. So you can look up and verify this is none other than Samuel the prophet. So what we find here is a genealogy that links the family of Samuel the prophet. It's just a different spelling. Kind of the original was Shemuel, as it says here. Verse 34, who was Shemuel? The son of Elkanah, just like we read in 1 Samuel 1:1. And now this is where we confirm it's the very same family. There's a lot of names that are repeated. The same way grandfathers, you know, names end up getting passed to sons and grandsons and all of that. So it can be confusing, but there's no doubt that we're talking about a single family genealogy. Shemuel or Samuel, the son of Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, the son of Eliel, the son of Toa, just as we saw in 1 Samuel 1:1, verse 35, the son of Zoph. Now that's where 1 Samuel 1:1 ended, with Zoph, the ancestor who was from Bethlehem. But here in Chronicles, it takes the genealogy all the way back. And there's some interesting things here. Who was the father of Zoph? The son of Elkanah. Ah, there was another Elkanah. So Elkanah actually was one of those family names that ended up being repeated. So, as you will see, was the name Joel. So a number of Joels, a number of Elkanahs in this particular family line. And remember, this is one of the family. Who is this family? This is one of the Levite families, as you're going to see, who actually had authority to do service at the temple. And in fact, their claim to fame was music, as we already saw. These were a family of musicians. Zoph, the son of Elkanah, the son of Mahath, the son of Amasai. Verse 36, the son of Elkanah, there's another Elkanah. The son of Joel, there's another Joel. The son of Azariah, the son of Zephaniah, the son of Tehath, the son of Asir, the son of Abiasaph. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. I didn't try to look it up. And who was Abiasaph? The son of Korah. What? You mean the Korah, the famous rebel Korah that God killed? Yep. Abiasaph, the son of Korah, verse 38, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath. That's why they're called the Kohathites. Here's your ancestor, whose kind of handle went on down with the family. The son of Kohath, the son of Levi, the son of Israel. So what was the point of me going through this whole thing over the first verse of 1 Samuel 1? Basically to prove to you that Samuel was a Levite. He wasn't an Ephraimite, he was a Levite, even though his family lived, either his father lived originally in either Judah or Benjamin, but transferred or eventually was living near Mount Ephraim in the tribe of Ephraim, but they were Levites. Okay. So what's this about Korah? Well, so you're saying that the prophet Samuel was a direct descendant of the rebel Korah. Yep. Did you know that? I bet most of you didn't know that. And the only reason we can know that is because of the genealogies. That's one of their values. Ah, but I thought Korah and all of his children were killed and went down in the pit. This genealogy says not so. So I'm not going to turn to number 16, which is the story of the rebellion of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. But if you read it, it does not say that all descendants of Korah died when they were swallowed up by that earthquake and that which God did. It does say that Dathan and Abiram came out of their tents with all their little ones, but it doesn't say Korah did. So I don't know. How is it that Korah was wiped out, Dathan and Abiram, all their family? It says all that appertaineth to them, meaning all their stuff. God made an example and killed them. I don't know, but is it possible, just one possible scenario, that we're already talking about an adult son of Korah, this Ebiasaph, who was already on his own and did not follow his father's rebellion, and therefore was not physically aligned with him in this rebellion against Moses, and therefore did not die when the ground opened up and swallowed his father and his wife and all of these others. Somehow, a lineage of Korah was not wiped out, because that's what we read here in 1 Chronicles. God did not choose to provide the details. You won't find the details in number 16. But there you have it. So God did, in essence, preserve the family line of Korah. It appears that with Dathan and Abiram, not so, unless they also had adult children who weren't wiped out and it was just their little ones who were still at home. I don't know the details of that. I didn't go to look it up to see if we can find anything else through the genealogy. But anyway, the point is Korah, the rebel Korah that God killed, was an actual ancestor of Samuel the prophet. All right, back to 1 Samuel 1. Hey, let's move on to verse 2. First Samuel 1, verse 2, and he, Elkanah, the father of Samuel, had two wives. Oh, man, here we go. Are we going to have to talk about polygamy? Yes, because I'm not just going to skate over it. He had two wives. The name of the one was Hannah, as you're going to find out, is ultimately the mother of Samuel. And the name of the other, Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. Okay, so what's the backstory on these two wives? And by the way, and which one was first and which one was second? God did not choose to record it. So again, the commentators like to speculate, this, that, and the other. We do not have an answer. I will read you a citation from the Radio Church of God Bible story books. Here's simple summaries because this was written ostensibly for children, which is not always written in the language for children, but here is what is said here, which this is from the Bible Story, volume 5, page 109. Quote, about a century and a half after the birth of Obed, because this was on the heels of covering the book of Ruth, by the way, which is why it's covering this, there was a man by the name of Elkanah living in a town in the high elevations of the Mount Ephraim region. So the worldwide ministry concluded that where they were living was not down in Bethlehem, but it was up in the mountains of Ephraim. He was a Levite, and he had two wives. This wasn't right, and he, being a Levite, should have known better. But there were many things not right in Israel in those times when the people had fallen so far away from God. However, the fact that this man had two wives for so many years was part of the means through which he was used to later bring another of God's servants onto the scene, referring to his son Samuel. Okay, and so one of the points made here, remember, this was a time in Israelite history when there was a lot of lawlessness. All right? And even though the high priest in the day, as we're going to be introduced to very soon, Eli, appeared in general to be a good man, meaning he had good intentions. He respected God and he sought to serve him, but he was a weak man. Okay? So in those days, and if you read, and again, Samuel was the last judge of Israel. Eli was the next to the last judge. And what you find, so then if you go back to the book of Judges and read through, the very last phrase or the last verse in the book of Judges says what? In those days, everyone was doing that which was right in his own eyes. So this was the setting. The very fact that you have a man like Elkanah, the father of Samuel, who appeared to be trying to obey, probably made him unique in his day. How many Israelites were actually following the rules concerning Sabbath and holy day observance, going up to keep the feast? You're going to find out Elkanah did. But if you assume just, well, all the families were doing what God originally told them to, you'd be making a mistake. You're talking about a lawless time when people were doing whatever they wanted to do. Concerning polygamy, I would suggest that you read the article originally written for the October 1963 Plain Truth magazine. It was entitled, "Here's the Plain Truth About Old Testament Polygamy," written by Herbert W. Armstrong. It's a very good read. It is the best single source of an article to explain the polygamy of the Old Testament and to prove that in every case where polygamy took place, it was a curse, never a blessing. And so people want to say, well, if God said this was wrong, why wasn't he striking them down with a bolt of lightning for having two or more marriages? The way it was described in our parent church was that in essence, this was a sin that God winked at. Oh, God winks at sin? Okay. In some cases, God simply lets human beings suffer the curses that come naturally by their rebellion. And this is seems to be one of those, because every time where an Israelite practiced polygamy, it always turned out bad, never good. And that was kind of the point of the 1963 article, and I think Mr. Armstrong did a great job of demonstrating that. And so it was certainly true in the case of Elkanah, because he had two wives, and that was nothing but strife, as we're going to read. Reminds me of the old country song by the Oak Ridge Boys, "Trying to love two women is like a ball and chain." Just another way of saying the same thing. Always a curse, never a blessing. And in fact, what Mr. Armstrong's article showed was, to the extent that there was the equivalent of Old Testament conversion, meaning a man who lived one way in his youth and then ultimately grew closer to God and changed his ways, like Jacob did when God changed his name to Israel, was very likely then put away these wives who weren't wives. For Jacob, it was likely the fact that Leah was his one true wife, even though Rachel was the one he loved. By the time that God had entered into this special covenant with Jacob, it's very likely that Rachel was dead and his only remaining wife was Leah. Even if he didn't love her, that was his illegitimate wife and the one that he had. Okay, so you read the article, but it's really got some fascinating aspects to it that you may not have seen before. But it's absolutely true. Polygamy is against God's law. Just one reference, you don't have to turn to it, Genesis 2:24. And this is the same thing Jesus Christ did in the Gospels whenever the Jews wanted to argue with him. Well, but Moses said this and Moses did this, and Jesus would cut through all of that and say, in the beginning, it wasn't so. So in the beginning, what did God establish for marriage? Genesis 2:24 says, "Therefore shall a man leave his father and mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh." And that means the union with one eligible man and one eligible woman, and they miraculously, by God, become one flesh. It's not just talking about sex. It's talking about a union, a covenant, which God makes whole. And a third can never be added to that union of the two. Polygamy is absolutely against the very image of what God is doing and working with the human family and the means by which he's bringing salvation. Jesus Christ is pictured as the head of that family, as you can read in Ephesians chapter 5. And he's not taken multiple wives. There's only one wife, which is the church. And even as he was married once to ancient Israel in the first covenant, it required his death in order for that union to be broken so that he could be eligible to marry a new wife, New Testament Israel. So all of that, I mean, we've covered that in so many other series and so many other sermons. But just because I just didn't want to slough off, you know, this question on the polygamy. And as you're going to see here, Elkanah did not have a happy home life. Now the question, again, we're back to, okay, but who was the real wife? Was it Hannah or was it Peninnah? We don't know for certain. You can run different scenarios. I like to run the scenario that Hannah was the first wife, the real wife. But being that she was barren, she did not have any children. Was it that Elkanah, in order to have heirs, took a second wife, justifying in his mind, like all of them did, so that he could have heirs? Now, a Levite should not be as intent on having heirs as much as those of the other tribes. Because again, the Levites weren't given property to have to hand down to male heirs. It wasn't the same kind of thing. But again, I don't know. I don't know how much in the days of Elkanah was he really being supported as a Levite by the locals from tithes and offerings? If the people were basically not close to God whatsoever, there's a good chance that a lot of the Levites were having to support themselves and weren't being supported the way God intended. Was Elkanah then literally having to act, you know, to control his own property and then trying to deliver his property down to an heir, and he had no heirs? I don't know. But that's one possible scenario, that Hannah was the real wife and he married Peninnah in order to get heirs. Could be the other way around. Either way, we've got family strife. Is it that he married Peninnah, got heirs, but he didn't really love her, and then he sees Hannah and goes, hubba hubba, and wants a second wife, and she's the one he really loved? Who knows? I like the first speculation better myself. All right, verse 3. This man, Elkanah, went up out of his city yearly to worship and to sacrifice unto the Eternal of Hosts in Shiloh. So Elkanah was respectful of the holy days, and yearly he's talking about now in particular the Feast of Tabernacles, the commandment to come up to the site to keep the feast where the tabernacle was. And this was long before the tabernacle ended up in Jerusalem. When Israel first came into the Promised Land under Joshua, the place where the Ark of the Covenant rested and where the tabernacle was established was in the city of Shiloh, where Shiloh, north of Jerusalem, if you look on your Bible maps. Okay. So where Elkanah and his family were living was almost due west of Shiloh. All right, so this man went up out of his city yearly to worship and to sacrifice unto the Eternal of Hosts in Shiloh. And the two sons of Eli, here's our introduction to Eli the high priest, who was responsible for the tabernacle and all of the worship, the religious services of God at the tabernacle. The two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, interesting characters, we're going to hear more about them, the priest of the Eternal. Hophni and Phinehas, the sons of Eli, were called the priests of the Eternal, were there. They were the ones actually doing the day-to-day responsibilities for the entire nation at the tabernacle of God. Were they good guys? Anything but. Verse 4, and when the time was that Elkanah offered, so he brought up as commanded and came up, in this case, probably the Feast of Tabernacles. And part of what they did, besides paying their tithes from the year, the ones who were faithful, that's when you settle up at the end of the year from whatever. And again, he was a Levite. He should have been living off the tithes. But Levites also had a certain amount of livestock. Again, even if it's true that the Elkanah wasn't having to kind of fend for himself. But if he was, and to the extent that he was growing crops, let alone raising animals, he was subject to tithe. So here he is at the end of the year coming up as required to Shiloh to celebrate before God during the 8-day Feast of Tabernacles and the last great day, and to pay his tithes from his increase from the past year. That's what he was doing. And there were special sacrifices that were involved, thanks offerings. And so part of that is what Elkanah was providing in honor to God. When the time, verse 4, was that Elkanah offered, he gave to Peninnah, his wife, and to all her sons and her daughters, portions. Okay, what's going on? Very likely, there were certain of the special offerings that were given that were not burnt offerings or sin offerings, that were totally burned up on the altar. Some of these thanks offerings were ones that were given. They were, the priests would slaughter them, and then a certain amount of that meat was taken, like almost like a portion of it was taken by the priests for them to share with their families, and a lot of it was given back to the family who actually provided the sacrifice. So this is talking about now some of these sacrifices that took place from the livestock that Elkanah brought to the feast. They were sacrificed by the priest, and then his portion was given back to him after it was cooked, and then he divided it among his family members. So of this meat that was given back, it said he gave unto he gave Peninnah his wife and all her sons and daughters portions. Verse 5, but unto Hannah he gave a worthy portion, and the commentators say this word is actually a more significant portion. In other words, the best portion he gave to Hannah. So Elkanah was showing preference for one particular wife over another. Unto Hannah he gave a worthy portion, more than he did to Peninnah or her children, for he loved Hannah. But the Eternal had shut up her womb. Verse 6, and her adversary, none other than the other wife. Her adversary also provoked her sore for to make her fret, because the Eternal had shut up her womb. So the jealous other wife, Peninnah, enjoyed tormenting poor Hannah, because she had children and Hannah did not. And in this rivalry and this negative relationship, which was not of God to begin with, you had the one in jealousy now intentionally trying to make the other suffer. So that's what Peninnah was doing to Hannah. The commentary, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says of verse 6, her adversary also provoked her sore. The conduct of Peninnah was most unbecoming, but domestic broils in the houses of polygamists are of frequent occurrence, and the most fruitful cause of them has always been jealousy of the husband's superior affection, as in the case of Hannah. And so it was. All right, verse 7. And as he did so, year by year, meaning this was Elkanah's habit, which was to go to keep the feast in Shiloh every year. He did what God commanded of him. He made his offerings. He paid his tithes. As he did so year by year, when Hannah went up to the house of the Eternal, so she, meaning Peninnah, the other wife, provoked her. Therefore, she wept and did not eat. So this was an ongoing thing. How many years did this go on? Doesn't tell us. But this is the way their family worked. One wife jealous of the other and provoking her because she had no children. Again, we've already seen Shiloh then was where the tabernacle was. So this was where they were going year by year. Okay, on to verse 8. Then said Elkanah. Now this one slays me. I don't know if I'm interpreting this right or not, but here's what happened. Then said Elkanah, her husband, to her, because here she is weeping and crying at the feast. Absolutely unhappy, which was supposed to be a time of celebration, but it was always a time of distress and consternation for Hannah. Then said Elkanah, her husband, to her, Hannah, why weepest thou? And why eatest thou not? And why is thy heart grieved? Am not I better to thee than 10 sons? Don't I make, as your husband, don't I make you more happy and enriched than any amount of children would? I kind of have a hard time seeing any husband getting away with that. Either his elevated view of himself, but there it is. And the truth of the fact was, no, Hannah in particular did grieve because she did not have children. So I think it's a lesson, you know, it's very understandable physically, and God made it so. From the beginning in the Garden of Eden and go back and see that God intentionally, you know, said that he was going to make those wives actually dependent upon their husbands and desire to be enriched and to have the greatest lives and existences physically upon this earth was going to be in that relationship of marriage and family. So this is just an expression of those things which naturally exist in the human minds, male and female. The benefit to God's people spiritually, unlike any of these in the Old Testament era, is that when you are called into God's church, you have an opportunity now to transfer your love and those things that enrich you the most away from that which is physical to that which is spiritual. And especially because Jesus Christ said that in the last days he was intentionally going to bring a sword to families. He said, I came not to bring peace on earth, but a sword. How so? By calling some into the church and not calling others. And there is a sort of division when you have certain members who are called by God, enlightened by God, baptized into God's church, and now set their sights on spiritual things of the coming kingdom of God away from the natural orientation that enriches human beings. And those ones who are not part of the church don't understand. They can't understand until God calls them. There's where family division happens between the called and the uncalled. But part of that which is required, even as, you know, Jesus Christ also talked about eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake, those who do not have families, spouses and families, in order to avoid breaking God's law, referring to divorce and remarriage situations where somebody is married but is not living with their rightful mate, but as long as that mate is alive, they have no choice. So they live a celibate lifestyle. Because they want to? No. Because to do anything else would make them violate God's law. So when you're called into God's church and God offers to you something of incredible value in the kingdom of God and a chance to become a king and a priest in his family government, he requires sacrifices. And for many, in order to keep from violating God's law, it means you can't be married. You can't potentially have children, whatever it may be, all the things that carnal human beings want. Because you would have to violate one of God's laws in order to do so. Whatever the circumstances are, what God has set before us is something of greater magnitude by far to hope for and to work for than something that is temporary in this flesh. So we should be different than these families of the Old Testament, including Elkanah and Hannah. They were not offered the things that you were being offered. So according to what they knew, what they understood, You know, God promised Israel a land flowing with milk and honey. He promised them physical things, property, wealth, children, you know, and peace from their neighbors. That was the most they could get, was a good life while they breathed. But there was no promise for them after they died. So of course, if all you had to look forward to was right now, then you'd want to make the most of it. You and I have been offered something of greater worth by far when Jesus Christ returns. And you and I are investing in that. And there's an opportunity for that to give us our consolation and our hope and our real sense of satisfaction. Hannah didn't have that. So by nature, she desired the things physical that many others around her had, including this other wife. But Elkanah says, "Am I not better than 10 sons?" And the answer was, "No, you're not." Because she really was in despair. So here they are at the feast, and once again, Hannah's being tormented by this other wife, quote unquote. And she is sad and she's despondent. So she goes to the temple, not the temple, she goes to the tabernacle in order to pray to God. Verse 9. So Hannah rose up after they had eaten in Shiloh, after this feast, and after they had drunk. Now Eli the priest sat upon the seat by a post of the temple of the Eternal. All right, what do we know from this? Eli actually held two different job titles. One was civil and one was religious. He was high priest, which is the religious office, in charge of the tabernacle. And all of the work of the tabernacle was given to the sons of Aaron. Okay? He was also a judge of Israel, which was a civil magistrate position. Okay? Which means he was in charge of the taking care of all of the government responsibilities to the extent that it existed in an organized fashion. All right, that's what the judges did all the way through the book of Judges. Now, here is Eli, also was one of those judges. So here he was sitting in a seat, and it was a magistrate's seat, if you will, a seat of honor that was positioned right outside of the tabernacle. So he was a judge of Israel as well as high priest, and this was a seat of a magistrate. The seat being, quote, by a post of the temple seems to suggest that it was strategically placed where Eli could observe the entrance to the tabernacle and the central activities of the sanctuary. He was in charge of it, right? Under God, he was responsible for the tabernacle. So he needed to be where he could supervise everything that was going on appropriately. That comes into play here soon. This placement of his seat near the post, or a significant post of the tabernacle, would allow him to manage the flow of worshipers and oversee the sacred rites. The post, quote unquote, here likely refers to one of the structural supports of the tabernacle, or the tent-like structure that housed the Ark of the Covenant there at Shiloh. These posts would be integral to the framework holding up the curtain walls of the sanctuary, and you can get all that detail if you go back to the original instructions that God gave through Moses and how that tabernacle was to be constructed piece by piece. A lot of that detail can absolutely be understood, and a number of sources and scholars have kind of put together images of all these different elements, which are could be an interest. All right. But Eli, in his God-given authority, both as a judge of Israel and as the high priest, now is sitting in this seat outside the main entrance to the tabernacle. And here comes Hannah. Verse 10, and she was in bitterness of soul and prayed unto the Eternal and wept sore. And here now, Hannah, outside of the tabernacle, is going to make a vow with God. In other words, she's going to seek to bargain with God. Verse 11, she vowed a vow and said, O Eternal of hosts, if thou will indeed look on the affliction of thine handmaid and remember me and not forget thine handmaid, but will give unto thine handmaid a man-child, then I will give him unto the Eternal all the days of his life, and there shall no razor come upon his head. All right, what's all involved in this? Hannah is saying, God, if you will create a miracle to allow me have a baby. And in particular, she was asking for a son. She says, I won't even be selfish with him. I just want the blessing of having this son, and I will devote him to your service. Now, as a Levite, as the son of Elkanah, any son would already be set apart. The Levites were always set apart automatically by birth for the religious service of the nation when they were obeying the law. So, in essence, Hannah couldn't offer to devote her son in a way that was already accounted for in the law of God. So furthermore, what she said was that she would actually offer him almost in a special capacity and as a Nazarite, right? Which is what she's saying here, that she would offer him to be a Nazarite for life. In one way, you can say this was pretty cheeky. In essence, bargaining with God. God, if you will give me this special miracle, then I will give this to you in return. As if she's going to do God a favor. And that's, she's in her distress, and this is all very understandable. But my point is for you and me to look at these kind of circumstances and back away from it. Look at it at 10,000 feet, if you will. Here's the problem with a lot of God's people today in our time. They will also attempt to negotiate with God, and you're the ones who should know better. Hannah can be forgiven for that. All of the ancient Israelites can be forgiven of that. You and I know better. When you're called into the true church of God spiritually, you understand that you are now called by God for a purpose, and He is guiding you and He is directing you. You and I should be asking always, as did Jesus, according to your will. Not my will be done, but your will be done. Hannah wasn't asking, but thy will be done. She was saying, God, please, please give me what I want. And if so, I will pay you back. A barter exchange. It's very understandable from a human carnal standpoint. It's not the way you and I should think about our relationship with God. You have been inspired to understand better. There is a better way. And when you come to understand and actually believe that you are in the hands of a living God who has a purpose for your life now and in the future, and you're willing to invest in that, submit to that, you can be blessed of all people. If, though, our natural selfishness, covetousness, all these things, what we want, continues to dominate, then we will rob ourselves of the good things, the joy and the peace and all that God said should be there for the people of God. We should be the most blessed people on the earth, regardless of our physical circumstance. According to your gifts spiritually by a loving heavenly Father, you should feel most blessed of all. Do we? Or do we still fret and desire more and ask and beg God and seek to bargain? If you believe it's His will, even as Jesus Christ gave us in that final prayer on the Mount of Olives, when He said, Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me, but not my will, your will be done. If you pray like that, you can never go wrong. You can never go wrong. Now, it just so happens that it was God's will to give Hannah a positive answer to her prayer. But I will tell you, beware, Because I've seen people in the church, I can think of certain circumstances in my childhood and early adult life, where there were families who, again, you know, who prayed to God, please, Father, let this child live. And if you do, I will devote him to you. And then by a miracle, the mother and child survived, and this father took it that that meant his son was destined to become a minister in the church. This is real. This is true. Because he was, quote, emulating this example of Hannah and asking God, please, if you let this child live, then I will devote them to God. And it happened, so it must mean this son was destined to grow up and become a minister in the church of God. Well, that wasn't true. And the fruits proved that it wasn't true. But it didn't mean the family didn't still believe it. And Raymond Cole suffered a lot of anguish over some of the misadventures because of those false conclusions. So be very, very careful about thinking you're going to bargain with God to get what you want. Doesn't work that way. In this particular case, God, it was his will and his purpose to give Hannah a son, to allow her to fulfill her vow, and then to use that son in a very powerful way. But I guarantee you, this was God's plan from the beginning, long before Hannah even thought about it. So Hannah promised that Samuel would be a Nazirite for life. Now, number 6, we're not going to turn there, gives you the law concerning the Nazirites and what that meant. In short, they would never cut their hair, and they would never drink alcohol, anything that came from the vine, including fresh grapes. So that is not specified in this, but the presumption is that everything to do with the Nazirite law would be involved. Another example of this was Samson, another judge of Israel, which you find in the book of Judges. But in that particular case, it wasn't the parents who offered Samson as a Nazirite for life. This was God who dictated it to the family and sent an angel, if you remember, and said, you're going to have a son, and he will be, by my edict, a Nazirite for life. So this was a very reverse circumstance from what happened here with Elkanah and Hannah. All right. Moving on. Hannah is praying to God, and as we're going to find out, silently, making this vow, this bargain with God. Verse 12. It came to pass as she continued praying before the Eternal that Eli marked her mouth. It means Eli sitting there on his magistrate's seat outside of the tabernacle sees this woman bowing down and her lips are moving. And Eli makes a mistake. He misjudges what is going on with this woman. It came to pass as she continued praying before the Eternal that Eli marked her mouth. He saw her lips moving. Verse 13, now Hannah, she spake in her heart. Only her lips moved, but her voice was not heard. So in essence, it's like, do some of you ever read and you kind of let your lips move by what you're reading, even though you're not really speaking out loud? Does that help your concentration? For some people, that's true. That's the way Hannah was praying here. Her lips moved, but her voice was not heard. Therefore, Eli thought she had been drunken. Why would Eli think that this poor, distraught woman who was coming to the door of the temple to pray to God was actually drunk? Very likely because there was a whole lot of that going on. As we're going to find out during this time, because of the misbehavior of the sons of Eli, It was a natural assumption on the part of Eli. This was another wanton female who was showing up during the feast at the door to the tabernacle for anything but a righteous purpose. And Eli said unto her, thinking she was one of these bedraggled women, "How long wilt thou be drunken? Put away thy wine from thee." He drew a conclusion when he didn't know, and he made a serious mistake in judging her. Verse 15, and Hannah answered and said, "No, my lord, I am a woman of a sorrowful spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but have poured out my soul before the Eternal." Verse 16, "Count not thine handmaid for a daughter of Belial, for out of the abundance of my complaint and grief have I spoken hitherto." In essence, she said, "I'm not some drunken woman that's here for a wrong purpose. I came here because I'm in mental pain and anguish, and I came to beseech God in prayer." Eli, one, because she's not drunk, she's able to express herself eloquently. He figures out pretty quickly after talking to her, he misjudged the entire situation. Verse 22, now Eli was very old. No. I'm sorry. I changed over to 1 Samuel 2:22, and the reason I did that because I want to confirm to you what was really going on. This is one of the proof. We'll get to this in the storyline later on. This is to answer the question: why was Eli quick to doubt the morality of Hannah? Because of what was regularly going on. 1 Samuel 2:22. Now Eli was very old and heard all that his sons did unto all Israel. And this is the same one that we already read about, Hophni and Phinehas. Because they were the sons of the high priest, then they also had the authority under God in order to do the service of the tabernacle. But they were expected, as are all servants of God, to do it with integrity. And these did not. All that his sons did unto Israel, and how they lay with the women that assembled at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. Was there a lot of illicit stuff going on right out in front of the tabernacle? You bet there was. And the point is that in case you think, and when we get to chapter 2 and see beyond, well, Eli didn't know. He assigned it to his sons, and he assumed they were doing what they should have. And they were misbehaving, but they were keeping it from their father. So he was innocent, and only they were guilty. Not so. We'll see in the story how God viewed it. And God tells the truth of it by what he does with all of these individuals involved in the storyline. But to understand what was going on at the very time that Hannah approached with her prayer to God, this is a proof that Eli knew what was going on. And Eli was responsible for it. Even if it wasn't he that was actually doing it, it was his sons that were misbehaving and creating this entire environment of ill repute around God's very tabernacle. But there is Eli sitting in his magistrate's seat right outside, which means he saw. He had every reason to know exactly what was going on, and he was allowing it to occur under his watch. So that's why he misconstrued who Hannah was and what she was there for. Because of proclivity for so many women to be there for the wrong reason. Back to 1 Samuel 1, verse 17. Eli answered and said to Hannah, "Go in peace, and the God of Israel grant thee thy petition that thou askest of him." And she said, Hannah said to him, "Let thine handmaid find grace in thy sight." So the woman went her way and did eat, and her countenance was no more sad. So Hannah prayed. She still had no way to know whether God was going to give her petition or not. But the high priest, who she respected for his office sake, acknowledged why she was there and actually asked likewise that God would answer her prayer in a positive way. Now, what's interesting, it does not say here that she ever revealed to Eli what had been her prayer. You can assume that. And maybe it happened, but this account does not say so. It says she was praying silently and only her lips were moving. And after she clarified that she was in distress and was pouring herself out to God, it doesn't say she relayed to Eli what her vow was. And so I like to interpret it that he didn't know, only that he took her seriously now for her sincerity and her piety, and therefore asked that God would grant her her desire, even though he had no idea what it was and it was going to involve him. I think that's a good place to stop. With that now, on the next installment, we will pick it up in verse 19 and carry the story forward.
The Church of God, the Eternal, has just presented the second message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, January 11th, 2025.